Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, where's Chuck and where's Julie? Neither one of them are here. This is Mark Poff. I'm filling in for Chuck and Julie. You know, have you ever done that in the past where you've told someone, yeah, sure, I'll do you a favor? Well, that's what I told them that I would do. So I'm here today filling in. And for those of you who may not know me, I'm Mark Poff. I am a retired law enforcement officer. I was a detective for about 10 years with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office down in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And just to give you some background of what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about law enforcement stuff. I'm going to take a little segment here and talk about something that's kind of near and dear to me. And then I'm going to bring in a buddy of mine, John St. Augustine. You've probably heard about him in the past about a lawsuit that I've talked about a few times. We're not going to talk about the lawsuit, obviously, because whenever you're in the middle of a lawsuit, you can't really talk about it. But my history or my background is I was a computer engineer for about 20 years. And then I just really decided as a computer engineer, and I worked for multiple companies. I used to work for a company called Digital Equipment Corporation, if you knew them. I worked for MCI, a phone company, for many years. I just always wanted to be in law enforcement. So I decided, you know what, I'm just going to do this. And so I kind of got out of the whole IT business and became a cop full-time. I'd been a reserve deputy for about 5 years working the street. It gave me an opportunity to try it out. I loved it. So I joined the El Paso County Sheriff's Office in the early 2000s. And for about 10 years, I was a detective specializing in computer crimes. I worked on probably about 80 or so homicides, many sex assaults, kidnappings, other types of law enforcement type stuff. If you really want to get my background or check into me, you can obviously just Google my name and click on one of the top two links, Mark Poff, and you'll see either my personal website or my business website down here in the Springs. I do a lot of business now as a consultant, specializing in computer forensics, cell phone forensics. The main thing, though, is cell phone records. And I could do a whole show on cell phone records and how the networks, the cellular network, how they know exactly where you are. They're tracking all this type of information and stuff that you have. And you know, I'd love for people to ask me questions because a lot of people don't really understand how much information that the cell phone companies actually keep on you all the time. They know where you are 24/7. If your phone is turned on, they know. So I loved my time in law enforcement. I retired a little bit early and I love doing consulting now, mainly for defense attorneys. I work occasionally for prosecutors, mainly with cell phone records, cell towers, technology stuff. So what I'd like to talk about today and what I asked John to come in and help me with is we're going to be talking about reviewing some, we're going to do three current law enforcement events that have happened in the last year or so that we think we can explain a little bit better. A lot of times people don't understand exactly how law enforcement works, different things that you're justified in doing, not justified in doing. We might even talk about qualified immunity. That's kind of a hot button right now. But one of the things that I want to do to start off with in the first segment, if we can call it that, is defunding the police. I mean, you know, all last year, we were kind of all stuck at home. And it was kind of the same thing for me from the standpoint of, you know, I constantly worked with attorneys. And so I'd constantly meet with them and work on projects. Well, then COVID hits. We're all stuck at home. We all get Zoom and we start Zooming with everyone. I do business all the way from Alaska to New York City. And, you know, I kind of love flying to these different locations to meet with attorneys. That ended. So I'm stuck at home. And of course, the first thing is I'm stuck with my wife who does consulting out of the house as well. So we're both stuck together. So I got relegated down here to the basement, to my lab down here to do a lot of my work. And one of the things I really talk to people about, and when I was back as a detective, I told everyone to stay out of Facebook, stay out of social media. It's just going to get you in trouble. When I was a school board member for 12 years, social media was just a nightmare. People were saying things about me. I hate social media. I hate everything to do with social media. Well, unfortunately, during some of these boring times that I had at the house in between projects, I found myself on my cell phone or on my laptop looking at Facebook. And I don't publish stuff on Facebook. It's very rare. I may talk about, you know, some cattle or something. But I just happened to see a post from a friend of mine. Now, I have conservative friends and I have liberal friends. I still consider them all my friends. I just understand that their values are a little different, or the things that motivate them are a little different. And sometimes we get liberal friends, if we don't hang out with liberals, through school. And that's exactly how this happened, is our kids and their kids were in the same elementary. And so our wives became friends. And so, you know, we were Facebook friends. And during all this stuff with George Floyd and everything, you know, I call it the summer of burning last summer, when, I mean, just everything just exploded. And then people started talking about defunding the police. And, you know, I'm looking at this as a retired law enforcement officer. It was driving me crazy to see all this stuff going on up in Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle. And it's like, you know, where is law enforcement? You know, where are the people keeping the control and keeping the peace? Well, then I see this post from my friend, and I don't respond to posts. I mean, I just never respond. I don't care what they say. I just stay out of it. And she talks in this post about how, you know, we really need to have a serious conversation about defunding police. And she started listing all this stuff about, hey, you know, what's going on in Minneapolis, and you know, and I sat there, and you know how they always say, you know, when you get an email you don't like, wait a day before you respond to the email. Well, unfortunately, I didn't even hesitate. And I'm a person who doesn't respond to posts. And I said, you know, I take offense to that. I take offense to you saying that you support defund the police. Do you really know what that means? And come to find out, she didn't. She didn't have a clue. Because I said, you know, this whole movement of defund the police is starting from a foundation of all cops are racist and we need to get rid of them. And you know, I put that out there and she started backpedaling real quick. I think she almost forgot that, you know, I was going to see this post. She knew I was retired law enforcement. And she says, well, that's not what it means. It doesn't mean to defund. It means to reform. Or, and then she started really getting paranoid and putting all of these posts out to try to backpedal from what she originally stated, which was to just get rid of law enforcement. And she tried to make it smooth and everything. And I was just not having any part of that. I said, you know, we can't even start a conversation. If you want to start the conversation with defunding police, that's not a starting point, because that's saying you want to get rid of it. And she's like, nah, that's not what I meant. And so I actually did a little research, which I don't like doing on stupid stuff. And I consider defunding the police pretty stupid, but I actually looked into this a little bit because it just was just driving me crazy how this whole movement about defund. And if you start, if you just ask someone, so you want the police to go away, you don't want any law enforcement. Do you really know what that means when you have none? And all these people wonder, some people, why crime is going up. And to me, it was a no-brainer. When I saw the footage from Portland, which was insane, and Seattle and Minneapolis and other places, New York City, just all the stuff where people are walking down the street just punching other people. And it's like, you know, how can so quickly can we go to where there's no law enforcement? Well, let me tell you how it can happen. When you lose 20 to 25% of your cops who just say, I'm going to go do something else. And a lot of people, especially I think liberals, think that law enforcement the people who take those positions are not highly intelligent people. Well, they don't know. You know, I was a computer engineer for 20 years before I got into law enforcement. And actually, I don't know if I can actually use the term, the majority of law enforcement officers have degrees, but I know a large number of law enforcement do. My daughter's in law enforcement. She has a master's degree. Her husband has a degree and he's in law enforcement. So these are highly intelligent people. It's usually people that are motivated to go into one career path, which is law enforcement, which was what it was for me. I was an engineer, but I just always had this drive to be in law enforcement. So I looked into this just to see what, first off, what does defund mean? It means prevent to continue to receive funds. So you're stopping funding is legitimately what defund means. It doesn't mean to reform. There, you know, if you want to talk about reform, then you can talk about reforming police. And that's a place where you can start a conversation to actually reform. I get it. Or enhance. But typically when you want to give someone more training, you know, because they talk about mental health and other things like that, you actually need to spend a little bit more money. So is your goal to make cops better, more knowledgeable, or highly or more effective law enforcement officers? Or do you just want to get rid of them? Because if you cut funding, it's all manpower. So if you defund the police, you're getting rid of cops. And even in Minneapolis, where the whole thing is completely backfired on them, they're actually throwing tons of money right now back at law enforcement in Minneapolis because they screwed it up and they know they screwed it up. So I found, you know, I was trying to figure out who actually created this term defund the police or took credit for defund the police. And actually, I found out there was a group called Black Visions Collective. It's actually in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And one of their leaders is this Candace Montgomery. So I found an article that was written just a couple weeks after the George Floyd incident, where they sat down with her and asked her all these questions about what she really meant by a lot of this stuff, you know, when we talk about defund police. And one of the comments that she said in this article, and you can find it, it's in The Intercept on June 5th. So you can actually go read this article for yourself. She doesn't say anything or she doesn't say that they want to reform police. She says, we want a total transformation. And I'm going to actually read some of these comments that she says in this article. In the wake of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis by Minneapolis police officers, a call to defund police departments has gained traction across the U.S. More people than ever are embracing the idea that the time for police reform has passed. So it's pretty clear that the founders of defund police have no desire to fix it, reform it, or whatever. And then they asked her, you know, so what do you think about all the destruction during all these protests? What do you think about all this destruction? And she goes, I honor and respect the ways in which our community has decided to grieve, even if it's not how I personally choose to grieve. Well, she's pretty much said, yeah, let it burn. And then she goes on, and you should read this. She goes on to say, we just need to make sure when we rebuild that basically they don't let white people take over the neighborhood. So that's just crazy. And so she was asked also about the city council, because, you know, if you remember the Minneapolis city council, they actually supported defunding the police. And so they asked her, you know, what kind of support are you getting from the city council? This was her response. Many of them have actually committed to us to really disband the Minneapolis Police Department and transition over the next few years away from having policing in Minneapolis. Now that sounds to me that her goal, and she's one of the ones founding this group that's promoting defund the police, this isn't about reforming or trying to fix or make cops, you know, deal with mental health people better, because we know that's one of the things they said. And let me tell you, mental health people are one of the most volatile people you'll deal with. And if you don't have a weapon, you know, because they're talking about, we'll have these mental health experts go out and deal with these mental calls, you're going to have a lot of people that are going to get hurt. But, you know, law enforcement is specially trained in how to deal with these people, but they still need to defend themselves. And to try to kind of just to finish this up before we get into some of these other things that we're going to talk about, she makes a statement, thinking about a transition plan away from the Minneapolis Police Department is going to be critical. What's next is continuing to engage our city council, but I think even more to engage the community to continue to bring this demand to their doorstep. While we can't allow this energy to die down, Minneapolis is going to be watched all across the country. Now, they were watched all across the country, and it totally blew up in their face. You know, Minneapolis had this big cut, defunded a lot of the police, and we know that a lot of the cops just retired, they quit, they just got out of Minneapolis. It was like, if you're not going to support us, and we know that if anything happens that we're going to be out hung to dry, they just didn't want to be law enforcement there, so they moved on to other places. At this point, a year later, they've thrown millions of dollars. They probably spent more money to try to fix what they broke last year, and all the citizens are complaining. You can read articles on the internet where they're saying, hey, okay, this is not good. You know, we need to fix this. This is not going well. People are getting hurt, and it's only going to get worse. And that's true everywhere. I mean, and I didn't want to do the research to go through to find out all these statistics about how crime has just taken off. I mean, we see it every night. If you watch Fox News or any of these news broadcasts, and of course the other networks, they don't even want to talk about this. What's happened in the last year that would cause crime to increase? Well, it's all these movements and all this stuff that's going on that they're basically walking away from law enforcement. Now, I wanted to say I wrote this down somewhere. One of the stupidest things I saw over the weekend was a quote from AOC, which she's notorious for this stuff. You know, if we want to reduce violent crime, if we want to reduce the number of people in our jails, the answer is to stop building more of them. It's that whole kind of philosophy. If you don't build more jails, we won't have more criminals. That's about the craziest thing I've ever heard. So some of the things that have come from defund police that are actually being implemented in certain areas, and a lot of this is virtue signaling. You saw last year when they're having to deal with all these protesters, they use pepper spray, you know, OC, all kinds of stuff to try to keep these people in line. And then what do? They want to take away their non-lethal use of force stuff. Don't use pepper spray. You know, don't use nightsticks. And I've got a caller here I'm going to bring on right here in a second. So the problem is when you take this stuff away, what's the only option to the cop? They have to use lethal force. Well, now you're going to have more cops shooting people because I would have, in the old days, I would have used a taser. I'd use OC, but they're trying to take those non-lethal tools away. So when you start messing with law enforcement, you know, things start really getting bad. But TJ, if you want, yeah, you can bring the caller on and see if there's a good question here. You're on.
Yeah, this is Johnny. I haven't called in a while, but I have a feeling that there's like several layers of generations that are here that are too busy playing their what are those games, and they're living in an unrealistic mindset, and then you give them a platform to say stupid things and try to implement stupid things, and they can't disconnect from the unreality of their games that they're playing on the TV set to reality, that real people are going to get hurt by implementing, experimental tests on the community.
So let me see if I hear what you're saying. I think I've got it. So they have these theories, you know, where they think that, okay, we don't really need so much in law enforcement. We need more of these mental health people, or we need to be doing things a little differently than what cops do. So let's give it a try. They try it on society and people get hurt.
Yeah. And killed.
Well, exactly. And there's more people that are going to die. I mean, because, you know, like they say, just like with a true person that has an addiction problem or something, they have to hit rock bottom before they finally say, we need to fix this. I think as a society, we're going to have to hit rock bottom before we're going to start fixing this stuff. And is that kind of where you were going with this?
Yeah, and I don't understand why comply is so difficult to understand. It's like, okay, if with your parents, you can run away and do all these crazy things, but when you get into a real world, if a police says stop, bad things are going to happen to you if you continue. And it doesn't seem to be computing in these people's minds.
Well, they're actually making it worse. Yeah, they're making it worse because they're promoting for people to resist and run. And you've actually seen on some videos where people said, hey, you need to get back in there with the cops during these protests and get it, you know, get in with them, you know, because then if they hit you, we can sue them. But what they don't understand is, yeah, and I've seen this in my entire career, and I've been asking all my friends the same question, the ones that are still cops and ones that have retired. Have you ever seen a compliant individual ever get shot and killed? And they're like, well, it would never happen. In all of these videos, and we're going to be going through three here, just right here in a second, they're always resisting. It's always they're trying to do something, and that's what gets them hurt. And the reason that more people are resisting and running and doing all this stuff is because people are telling them to do it.
Yeah, and I've had, I'm 62. I had run-ins with police when I was like 17. They say stop, you know. Either they even put on handcuffs, they just want to talk to you, and then take off handcuffs, let you go. You're not doing anything. As a teenager, I did some stupid things. I'm walking down the middle of Carlisle Boulevard early in the morning, thinking like, you know, it's early in the morning, no car, and cops came and said, hey, you might not want to do that. And so I've done some stupid things. I always know, I just know my parents taught me you respect the teachers, and I don't know about the ones now because they're teaching a lot of dickers, a lot of crazy stuff. But I think it comes from the household. It really starts in households. My parents always said, you go to school and you start acting crazy, you don't have to worry about them. You have to worry about us.
Right. And my kids were the same way. Yeah, they didn't have to worry about the teachers. They had to worry about when they got home. But hey, Johnny, hey, thanks for the call. We're going to move on and talk about some more stuff, all right?
All right, appreciate your time, man.
All right, have fun. So, hey, to finish this up, and I really appreciate that call in, is right now you're also finding in some places they're actually telling their cops not to enforce traffic violations. I don't know about some of the other people, but I've seen, you know, Mad Max, you know, and Road Warrior and stuff. You know, so a lot of the driving here in Colorado right now, even after the pandemic, is a little crazy. If you told the cops not to enforce, you know, traffic violations and don't pursue, don't go after people, I mean, you're going to be taking life in your own hands when you get on the interstate. So this whole defunding thing, I want to kind of wrap this up because I really want to talk about these other type of cases and stuff. Let's bring in John if we could. Actually, I'm seeing here that somebody on the TJ, you have someone else who has a question. You can bring them on. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh yeah. Thank you for hosting today. I remember when Eric Holder got involved with the local police departments with new regulations. You probably know a lot more about it than I do, but it seemed like they were trying to minimalize or marginalize local police departments. And the way I see it going with defund police departments is they want to eventually federalize the police departments, and where localities won't have the control that we normally have. But meanwhile, those that can afford it will have security, and they will be able to go to and fro, you know, in their, you know, security cars and their Ubers or Lyfts, and they'll have fences around their gates, around their homes. Whereas the rest of us are going to just have to fend for ourselves. I mean, do you see that is what is coming? And if it is, what can be done about it?
That's absolutely where I think we're heading. And that's a political view from my standpoint that others may have different opinions on. I've been watching this, you know, if you want to call it the erosion of local control, local law enforcement, you know, sheriffs are kind of the whole foundation of the United States with these local sheriffs. And then what happens is even in places where the local law enforcement says, you know, that was a good shooting. And I know that's not a good term, but they always say that it's a good shooting, it's a justified shooting. All of a sudden the feds come in and say, well, we're going to investigate for civil rights. Well, if the federal government comes in and says, we're going to investigate for civil rights violations, are they not kind of playing the race card saying, okay, you shot and killed this guy. The local district attorney said that it was a legal shooting, but then they're going to investigate to see if there's any racial bias in what they did. They're not playing the race card.
It makes them afraid to enforce the law and subsequently to even be on the police force. So that's another way to, you know, defund or you know, get rid of local police forces where nobody wants to join. I just see that as what's happening. I don't know if you see that or not.
Right. Nobody's protesting the FBI right now or the Department of Homeland Security. They're all protesting. Right. They're all saying defund police. They're not saying, now they did go after ICE because that was another agenda that they have issues with. But, you know, I definitely see that there's this whole push that they're trying to get local law enforcement to kind of get in line with what the feds want.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, I definitely see that. So, hey, thanks for jumping in. That was awesome.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to move on to the next phase. I doubt we're going to make it to the third phase or third segment today. But so what I want to do is I want to introduce John St. Augustine. It's kind of an interesting differential between the two of us. We've worked together for years. We've worked on projects together since we both retired from the sheriff's office. John has worked on numerous homicide investigations. He's extremely knowledgeable in homicides. He was actually retained to look into the, how can I forget, JonBenet Ramsey. He's worked on the Lacey Peterson case out in California. Like me, he's done consulting nationwide. In fact, he's done some consulting up in Canada on different cases and training. We go around and do training as well. And John is also, he was the commander of investigations at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. A lot of his responsibilities had to do whenever there was an officer-involved shooting or a use of force issue. John always headed that up from our agency, and I got to work on some of them. We had a shooting, an officer-involved shooting that him and I worked on. Actually, we've had multiple that we've worked on together. So John is extremely knowledgeable when it comes to use of force, justifiable shootings, things like that. So John, it's good to have you on the show. Hopefully that was a good enough introduction.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
You bet. So I'm going to kind of lay these out, and then I'm going to ask some questions, and we're going to talk about some of this stuff. So the first one I'd like to go through is the Dante Wright shooting. And this is an interesting shooting that here lately, kind of the view here kind of threw me off a little bit. You see. Dante Wright was an individual that was accidentally shot and killed by an officer. Unfortunately, I mean, it doesn't matter, unfortunately, where this happens, because wherever it happens, it's unfortunate. But it actually happened up in Brooklyn Center back in April during a traffic stop. I want to lay this all out because I don't have video for those that are also just listening. I think we're all familiar with this case. It's a you know, I hate to even say this, a routine traffic stop. They're pulling them over for like expired plates or something simple like that. And then they go up, and there's actually two officers involved, because Kim Potter, who's the senior officer in the car, she's actually training the other person. The person is new. So they're going through traffic stops. Obviously, I've been through this. I've given training, so I understand both sides of the equation of having a two-person team. So they go up and make contact. They get his information. They go back and they find out that he actually has warrants. He has outstanding warrants. Now, in the state of Colorado, and John and I can really only talk about how the laws are in Colorado versus how the laws may be back in Minnesota, but you're required to make an arrest. If somebody has outstanding warrants, you can't just say, well, I don't want to do my job. I'm just going to, you know, let them do it. That's just not how it works. So they go back up to, in effect, an arrest, and he resists. You know, when they start to put him in handcuffs, you can see this whole thing on video. He starts to pull away. He tries to get away from him. He's trying to get back in his car. Now, one has to assume, why is someone trying to get back in their car? It's so they can flee. So he attempts to get back in his car. And then you actually see on the body cam, you see Officer Potter. She says, "I'm going to tase you," you know. And then she, you know, says, "Taser, taser, taser." And then you hear, you know, a bang where she actually shoots him. And this is somewhat, this is not the first time that this has happened, that someone's mistaken a taser for a handgun. And John, you've done with these kind of shootings and stuff, the high stress of being involved in a traffic stop where someone's starting to resist. Have you ever heard of officers mistaking their taser for a gun?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was actually involved in a case a couple of years ago in Kansas, very similar situation to what happened up in Minnesota. And what happened in this particular scenario is that there was a female officer and a male officer who made a vehicle stop. And there was this particular individual in the vehicle was resistant. And as they were fighting with this individual, what ends up happening is the officer, in the same scenario, a female officer says, "Taser, taser, taser," and actually shoots this individual. Now, in that particular scenario or in that particular case, the driver of the vehicle actually survived. Unfortunately, the one in Minnesota, Mr. Wright, ends up passing away. But, you know, when you look at these cases, right, you have to look at, you know, when you hear this particular deal from the officer, when Ms. Potter is saying, or Officer Potter is saying, "Taser, taser, taser," that is actually part of the training that many officers throughout the country receive. When they do taser training, one of the very first things they tell you to do when you're going to deploy a taser is to actually say, "Taser, taser, taser." I haven't reviewed the video in its entirety. You mentioned that she had said, "I'm going to tase you." All I heard was the taser, taser, taser part. And that inherently is something that you would hear, you know, almost every law enforcement officer who deploys a taser. That is what the training requires, is that you mention taser, 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 so that the officers around you know that you're going to be deploying a less than lethal deal. When you pull your weapon out, you never mention gun, gun, gun. You never mention really anything. But in the situation of a taser, you do mention taser, taser, taser before you deploy that less than lethal weapon.
Right. And you know, obviously I received the training because I worked for a short period of time on the street. And even in investigations, there were some tasers that we could check out. And actually, I kind of went into law enforcement right when tasers came out. And so when the tasers first came out, there was two things that changed. One is they looked just like guns. And the second thing is we used to wear them in these low holsters that would actually be under our duty weapon. So basically you would grab your duty weapon at your waist and then you would reach down below, you would have your taser. So it'd be both on your strong arm. So what would happen is in the heat of the battle, they'd reach down and grab their gun and think it's their taser and shoot them. So they said, okay, we can't do this. And plus we don't want people to distinguish or not be able to distinguish between a gun and a taser. So the main manufacturer of Taser completely changed the design. They made them yellow, you know, all kinds of stuff. They make them cross draw. If you actually look at their bat utility belts, whenever you see an officer on duty, you'll see that most of them are cross draw. That's the popular style now. So they can still use their strong arm, but they got to go all the way across their body. And there's a lot of training, and they have yearly in-service training to just reinforce with officers the difference between taser and gun, so there is no confusion. But I can tell you, even with that, these mistakes do happen. And I don't want to say they're common, but they're not uncommon. Now, they say that they're documented a few times a year. I would tell you, if they say that these kind of events are documented a few times a year, they're happening a lot more often than that. If an officer, you know, pulls his gun and says, oh, man, I meant my taser. He's going to put it back in his holster. He's going to reach and get his taser. He's not going to document that. He's not going to admit that he made that mistake. So I know it's somewhat commonplace. I mean, we heard it all the time where someone's like, man, I accidentally pulled my gun instead of my taser. So this is something that has happened. It's not like this is the first time it's ever happened. And so I know she's being charged with what we would call criminally negligent homicide. They're calling it second degree manslaughter back there. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's tough. I mean, you really have to look at the entire investigation. But on the surface, you know, I think you can eliminate right off the bat any intent or premeditation, right? So you're definitely not dealing with a first degree murder type of situation. In Colorado, right, that would be first degree. Second degree would be knowingly. I think you could even eliminate that in this case that, you know, Officer Potter's intentions, at least from her verbal commands, don't appear to be something where she knowingly wanted to take a life of this individual. I think, again, what happened here, and you know, there's going to be people on both sides of the fence as to whether or not, you know, she intended to do this. I think there's potentially a training scar. I think, you know, when... you know, she was obviously she was in this fight or flight type of situation in her mind. I think in that brief moment, she thought she had grabbed her taser when in fact she grabbed her weapon. And unless you're constantly training with both of those weapons, you know, on your person, when you're, you know, you're actually on the range and you're given these different scenarios, you really, you know, your natural tendency is to just draw. And I think what may have happened here is you got to look at where the placement of that taser was located on Officer Porter. Was it on the same side as her weapon, as her lethal weapon, her gun? And if it is, when she drew that, right, is it something where she could have easily confused those two weapons? Much like what you're saying, Mark, where if it's on the opposite end, right, it's not natural for you to go across your body to draw your duty weapon in a lethal situation. I think what you're going to find in this is that she probably had both weapons fairly close to one another. And in that brief moment, for whatever reason, she thought that it was in fact her taser and not her duty weapon by just her verbal response, by saying, taser, taser, taser. So it's right. an unfortunate event.
There's no doubt she thought she had her taser.
Yeah.
And here's another thing. And actually, Leo asked a great question, which I want to make sure we answer. Mm-hmm. She is a longtime veteran.
Yes.
Tasers have only been around for a short while. So when she probably first went through training and she first became a cop, because you get all this training up front at first, and then you go through every 6 months or every year, I think about to answer Sandra's question, about every 6 months to a year, you go through in-service training. You have to shoot four times a year, different things like that to make sure you stay proficient. But a lot of this is memory, muscle memory. So you kind of get used to how that works. She probably went through half of her career before she ever started carrying a taser. So her initial training, which is, you know, that intensive boot camp type of training, probably she had no training with a taser. She probably just started getting the initial 1 or 2 day training on taser. And then every year they may or may not talk about tasers. So that could also be the fact that because she's an older officer. Leo asks a great question that I really needs to be answered. And he goes cross draw.
Right.
You know, he's asking about the cross draw. Why make it harder to access the tool that you're supposed to be using first?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, the problem is law enforcement is a dangerous job. And so, you know, a lot of the times, you know, situations rise to where you need to have that lethal force available to you quicker, right? Than less lethal, because you only have a fraction of a second if somebody's coming at you with a knife or coming at you with a gun to draw that lethal force weapon. And so what I would tell you is, you know, that cross draw is to prevent that confusion. Much like what you're saying, Mark, about, I think the big problem in this particular case is you're going to find out is that the policy and procedures of the training that officers receive regarding taser are not the same as what you see with officers who train with their lethal weapon, with their handgun. What I mean by that is typically quarterly, right? You have to qualify, hit a target, right? So many times from close quarters up to typically 25 yards. What I think you'll find is that a lot of these agencies, law enforcement agencies, don't have the same requirement for less than lethal, right? Because I think the mindset
is more
expensive. Yeah, it's exactly.
Every time you deploy a taser, it's a couple bucks or a few bucks. Right. Actually, I think it may be as much as $5 or $10 every time you deploy it, where a handgun, if you deploy it, it's a few cents per round.
Right. So what they're thinking is, you know, we don't need to go over this training every quarter. We give them the training. We sign off that they, you know, took less than lethal training with a taser. We give them, we issue it. And then maybe, just maybe, there might be some additional training in the future. But it's, again, you talked about muscle memory. You're not building that muscle memory if you're only using a device maybe once every year or every other year. So how do you build on that, right? And unfortunately, in this situation, I think what happened is she was intending to go for her less than lethal. And I think, you know, by accident. And I think at the end of it, if I remember right in that audio, and it's been a few months since I listened to that piece, but I think she actually said something to the effect of, oh, no, I think I shot him. So that was a response after she had already fired her weapon, you know, thinking that it was a taser. She says, taser, taser, taser. The handgun goes off. And then she's like, oh, no, I think I shot him. And the vehicle takes off, and I believe it crashed down the road, and then ultimately.
Yeah, that part I don't know, but here's a couple interesting points that you just brought up. First off, to kind of end on Leo's note, I would also agree you want to have your lethal weapon your fastest you can get to. I mean, if I have to make a split second decision to save my life or someone else's, my first instinct should always be my handgun first. Then if I can consciously have the thought process, you know what? I can go with a non or less than lethal. So they want you to take more time to actually get the taser and make sure that to protect yourself and others, your gun is always your first choice. But another thing is, if you've ever deployed a taser, which I have a few times because I went through the original training and I went through the in-service, it pops. Now, it's not as loud as a gun, obviously. But when you're in a high-stress situation, one of the first sensory things that goes away is your hearing. You don't hear so good. You know, when you're fighting or whatever, that's why they always teach cops to yell. You know, it's because people don't hear as well, you know. So when she heard that bang go off, you know, and she says, some people would think, how could you not know that you didn't shoot them? Because a gun is a lot louder than a taser. Well, during a high stress environment, her skill set or, you know, auditorial, some of these words are tricky for me. You know, she may not have registered that and said, wait a minute, that was a little louder than a taser I'm used to. Another thing in training with tasers is they normally had one or two tasers and they handed them to you. You'd like come up to the line, they'd load it up for you and they'd say, here, shoot the taser.
That's correct.
What good is that? You don't do that with my handgun. You don't have somebody walk up there and say, okay, here's your gun, shoot it. You have it in your holster and you practice drawing it and you practice shooting it for that muscle memory.
Right.
So taser training needs to be a lot more extensive. But the key with her, and we're actually taking a lot more time on this stuff, which is great. We could talk just for a brief second on immunity. Qualified immunity. Now, I don't know what it is in Minnesota, but in Colorado, we do have qualified immunity, which is basically if you're doing something and you're following policies and in good faith, you know, you're covered for this stuff. But obviously, nowhere in policy does it say in that situation to shoot someone. So we'll see how that plays out. And that, to me, that's kind of a separate issue, how it plays out in the Minnesota court systems, how it would play out here in Colorado would probably be a little different. Any last minute things on that?
Yeah, you kind of alluded to this a little bit, Mark, but I would tell you, I don't think, you know, this is the end of seeing that type of scenario play out. I think you're going to see, as long as, you know, the issue with tasers is that it deploys by a trigger, right? And much like a handgun, it deploys by pulling a trigger. And I think as long as you have that kind of system in place, it's very difficult under a very stressful situation, if that weapon is close to each other, how to distinguish that when you're in the heat of, you know, going into that fight or flight mode, right?
Unless even with a crossbow.
Yeah, even with a crossbow, I would tell you. Yeah.
And law enforcement now is also trained a lot more to use the taser more often.
Right.
So it might be that the routine now is, you know, taser, you know, or whatever. I mean, I could see where that confusion is. The more options you give someone, you know, if I have two choices, left or right, I'm going to be right most of the time. But if I have to hit like whack-a-mole, am I going to use my OC spray? Am I going to use my taser? Am I going to use my gun? Am I going to use my nightstick? When you have all this stuff trying to go on a brain on a split second process, people are going to make mistakes.
And when you have both being trigger systems, I think that's
right.
Naturally what's going to happen is you're going to have, it won't be the last event. Like I said, I worked a case in Kansas, very similar situation. Officer thought she was deploying her taser and it ended up being her handgun. And the only difference is in that situation, fortunately, the person who was shot ended up living. In this particular case, you know, the individual ended up dying, unfortunately.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So the second scenario, this will probably be the last one that we'll be able to talk about it. And then hopefully, you know, we'll be back again to talk about other scenarios and other type of cases and stuff. I actually also want to talk about some homicides. We can talk about JonBenet, all kinds of stuff. The next one is, which I think is a little trickier. This one's kind of straightforward. We know what she did. She made a mistake. Is the Andrew Brown Jr. case in North Carolina.
Okay.
And a lot of people, I don't think, really understand how this kind of works. We've been on some TAC operations, so we kind of get this. So what happened was is they're serving an arrest warrant for drug-related offenses. I believe he was wanted for selling cocaine and heroin to some undercover cops. This is what we refer to as a felony contact. And people need to understand you have routine traffic stops, which there is no such thing as routine. But law enforcement does not do felony traffic stops on every traffic offense. You know, felony or the high risk contacts. And if you've seen the video, and I hope most people have, it's a smaller agency, which means they don't have all this high tech equipment. When we worked at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office, we had a thing that we jokingly called the Bear, which is a big armored personnel carrier. So whenever you had these high risk things, you'd pull up in the Bear. So if you started taking rounds as you're coming in, you'd be safe until you deploy your officers. In this case, you see them in the back of a pickup truck. They pull up to this house to serve this arrest warrant. They jump out. He's in this vehicle. That's probably already, I don't know if they knew that he was going to be in the vehicle or he was supposed to be in the house at the time they pull up. You don't get to always decide the scenario of what you're going to run into. I mean, the problem is when, you know, I used to always say, you know, people would ask me, what's the dangerous thing you could ever do being in law enforcement? I said, it's kicking a door because I don't know what's on the other side of that door, you know? And we've had officers, we had Hugh Martin, you know, kicking a door and he was gunned down. So whenever you get into these high risk scenarios, that's why they have vests on. That's why they have these weapons, is to protect themselves. So they all jump out. He's in the vehicle. I'm sure if they didn't know he was in the vehicle, they're like, okay, that's not good. So they circle the vehicle. I mean, it's their job to place him in custody. If they all ran to one side, everybody would have said, well, man, that's pretty stupid. You know, you should have surrounded the vehicle, which they did. All had their weapons drawn. And they told them, I can't remember the exact phrase, but one of them was trying to open the door on him and he's backing up and then he goes forward. Well, the bottom line is a car is potentially more deadly than a gun. And so as soon as he drives off towards a person, they start shooting at him and he's killed. And a lot of people got upset over that. And what are your thoughts about that whole scenario?
Well, I mean, I'm probably counter to what a lot of people in the law enforcement community would think on this one, Mark. And, you know, I'm just looking at it objectively. But, you know, if you had told me it was patrol guys or ladies that were up on a stop and the shootout happened and as a result of that, it might be a little bit more understandable. But when you're talking about a tactical unit going in to execute an arrest warrant, you would think that there's a little bit more planning involved in the execution of that arrest, right? And what I mean by that is typically in these types of situations, you have eyes on the ground and you've done it before, you know, where you have somebody in plain clothes who's just monitoring the house, right? Monitoring activity. Are there dogs? Are there children? You know, what are potentially, you know, some other things that we have to contend with before we deploy a lethal weapon, right? So because it's a high risk type of situation, in this particular scenario, you want to be in control as best you can of the layout of how this thing is going to go down. And what I mean by that is, if you know he's in the vehicle, why would you want to create that jeopardy for the tactical unit that's going to be approaching? And so, you know, it's always easy to armchair quarterback, and I don't want to be too critical about, you know, law enforcement in this particular situation, but in a lot of these types of situations, you want to get that person out of the vehicle. You know who he is. Now, unless he just committed a murder, unless he just committed a rape, right? What is the urgency and exigency in executing it at this particular moment, right? Do you create a particular situation where by going in immediately and surrounding the vehicle that you put your officers in harm's way, because that vehicle has potential to be mobile, right? You can back into an officer, you can go forward into an officer. We don't know what's in the car. So the idea is, if the guy is out of the vehicle and he's in the home, you can do a surrounding call out. You can surround the house, right? And say, sir, you need to come out. We have a warrant for your arrest. And you can use other ways of getting him apprehended. So in this scenario, it's very easy to say, you know, law enforcement, you know, was attacked with his vehicle, or there was a potential of that harm. And yes, that's, you're absolutely right. The car was moving, but I think in some ways they kind of put themselves in that situation by not properly planning the execution of the arrest, right? And whereas if you get a patrol officer who's just going up on a vehicle and then all of a sudden it just goes to crap, and they, you know, now all of a sudden the officer is in harm's way because they think that they're going to get ran over, and you have to deploy lethal, then you deploy lethal. In this case, my understanding, and again, I don't know a lot of these specifics, and it's kind of unfair without reading all the data on this, the investigation, but my understanding is that the suspect in this case was not home the night before. So obviously somebody was doing some kind of surveillance or intelligence gathering to know that he wasn't in the home, that he was in a vehicle. So why not just sit on it, wait till he gets into the house, and then simply call out, you know, do a surrounding call out. You have the house surrounded, right? Come on out. And typically those types of situation end up a lot more peaceful because they realize there's not many options, right? They can't come out and just run away. They can't get in a car and just leave. You surround and call out. In this case, they surrounded the vehicle. The vehicle ends up moving forward. And then obviously based on those actions, one of the officers thought that one of the other officers was in harm's way and actually shoots his weapon and ends right. up, you know, ends up hitting the suspect in this case.
You know, John, I actually wish we had a little more time to discuss this. I actually was a little long-winded at the beginning, unfortunately. And so I'm hoping we just got about another couple minutes, about a minute and a half to go. But let me see. So here's the key. I do want to talk about this a little bit more, because a lot of times in law enforcement, we don't get to pick and choose the situations. So it'd be good to know, was he inside when the guy who told him, yeah, go for it now, he's inside, and then he walks out at the last second? So there's a lot of different scenarios, but the bottom line is, and I think to end this whole thing is, if you don't resist, you're not going to get hurt. And that's kind of the old thing is, if you cooperate with law enforcement, you're not going to get hurt. So if you guys like how this went today, make sure that you tell Chuck and Julie that, hey, whenever you guys take a vacation, and I think you should take more vacations, I want you to have Mark and John come in here and do the guest host so they can talk all about all this law enforcement stuff. So, you know, then I can come back. If you don't like how it went, don't tell anybody. So hopefully everything went well. I think we're wrapping it up at this point. Have a great week.